Maybe he'll come into the chat room.
In there now?
I can't tell if it's 100 or 0.
Probably 0.
Yeah, I think it's leaning towards 0.
It was like minus 100. Like 100 people said they weren't going to be able to make it.
that would make more sense. Like 7.6 billion, give or take a few.
No, I can't go.
Can't make it. Can you imagine being rejected by 7.6 billion people?
Endured either way.
Like, we're not going to make it, okay? All right. Allison, I understand you're all busy.
Nobody wants to hang out with you.
Yeah.
One person on the planet is interested.
Someone's there. There's a viewer. You play to your audience. If you don't have one, play to yourself. Oh, they're gone.
Three seconds. They're like, oh, wait, this is the wrong group.
I don't want to be here. Not what I came for.
Never what I came for.
I was on this Zoom call the other day. Robert Saltzman is his name.
Geez, you have no, there's no anonymity in this group, huh? You just blurt out people's names.
Well, he's a public figure.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so you were on his Zoom meetup.
I was on his Zoom meetup. Yeah.
Yeah. Who these people are.
Well.
Robert Saltzman.
Yeah. He's an enlightened former photographer. Well, I guess he's still a photographer, but perhaps that's not his principal way to make a living any longer. Yeah. I don't think he does weddings and bar mitzvahs. And he had a couple of guests on there, some enlightened friends. One guy named John, Enlightened John. And then there was Enlightened Sudamo.
So he determined these people were enlightened and could be friends on these calls?
Yeah, he knows them.
Are they like accredited enlightened people? I mean, they should probably be accredited.
By the Enlightenment Accreditation Board?
They have a light workers accreditation.
Oh, are they light workers?
Well, no, I'm kidding. I mean, yeah. The whole thing is so ridiculous.
I know.
I'm like, who what accredited light worker?
Yeah, well, I'd like to be one of those. I mean, I am a Universalist Life Church minister. I'm Rev.
That's accredited. You can join their group.
Oh, yeah. So, Sudamo.
Sudamo, that's the best name ever.
Sudamo Bhikkhu. He's a, you know, he wears robes.
Well,
he could be a...
He's got the best name.
Yeah. Definitely. And he lives in Thailand. So it was fun. It was an international Zoom meeting. Switzerland, Mexico, U.S., Thailand, maybe some folks from Europe.
There was a enlightened meeting.
Yeah. There was an Indian gentleman on there, too. He was fun.
That's
he wanted
to change from our white bread to
incestuous. Definitely.
Meeting.
He wanted to be counted as enlightened. And so during the call, he, you know, let everyone know that he had stopped seeking. So he was self-qualifying.
Well, what else do you, I mean, who is...
What's the point of having three...
Who's the accredited...
Only three enlightened people on the call if you could have four.
Who's the accrediting body of certifier? I mean, what...
I don't know. I don't know. I think Trump may have closed that department. You know, for budgetary reasons. So
no,
this
no, we keep that. We get rid of art, but keep them on life.
So Sudamo responded to a question from, I think, an Italian fellow who confessed that he still uses cigarettes and alcohol.
And that, horrible,
I mean, I was like, what am I doing on this call? What kind of enlightened group is this? Someone uses cigarettes and alcohol?
Loser.
Oh, man.
I would never be anything like that.
So he asked Sudamo, and he used the word discipline. You know, Sudamo is at least portrays himself as a renunciate, you know, Buddhist monk. Don't know what he really is.
Doesn't drink, doesn't smoke. I mean, what are his bizarre...
So Sudamo is a very, he's an aroused guy. I mean, according to the group, you know, he is in possession of a certain enviable understanding. So he went on this, you know, candid rant about the mind. And, you know, it was like hearing Nirsagadatta speak through the emphatic voice of a non-Asian Buddhist monk. And I was like, that's interesting. You know, usually that kind of non-dual ranting is something Hindus are allowed to do, but Buddhists don't do that, really. But it was getting on my nerves. Not because it wasn't true. It didn't matter whether it was true or not. It was that he kind of lost, well, he lost me, because he was... You know, like you can get self-absorbed on his rant. So it wasn't my call, but for whatever reason, I unmuted my mic and I just said, "All right, that's it. Hold on a minute."
Oh, I'm so surprised.
I said, "I appreciate you being excited about this, but you know, you're kind of ranting in our face. Can you dial it back a little bit?"
I checked your call.
Well, we were all on the call together. I just, you know, I was like, I had to slow the guy down. It was like, hey.
What did he say?
Anyway, it pissed off Robert Saltzman. Because he, you know, yeah, he thought I was going to be unfriendly to the call or hijacking shit, which at least for that moment I was. And said something like, Jesus Christ. You know, you could tell he was, you know, I was like, I just got here. You don't have to go Jesus Christ on me so soon. Let me warm up a little bit before you Jesus Christ on me. We made friends later in the call. I clarified, you know, that I just felt that if this was going to be a, you know, a mutual discovery, that it was unpleasant to be, you know, yelled at. Anyway, it worked. I mean, Sudamo, for the rest of the call, was more measured, you know, and a little more cordial in his responses. And, later on in the call, he actually invited me to say something.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that's not a good idea. So I thanked him for the opportunity to speak, but decided not to take him up on it.
No.
No. But I was in the chat room being as annoying as I could be.
Why didn't you take him up on the talking part?
Well,
is he just hopeless? No point.
Well, you know, because then you start, you know, lecturing.
Right.
And it was like, yeah, no, it's, I could certainly run this meeting. I'm not shy about that, but it's your meeting, you know, it's not my meeting. And, yeah. And, I see things a little differently maybe and communicate them a little differently rather than, you know, yelling at people from a overly confident, non-dual point of view. It's fun to kind of like, you know, tiptoe up to the precipice together.
Yeah, they're not accustomed to that sort of thing, so they just throw the ball back in your court. Like, I'm the leader now. I'm giving you an opportunity to be the leader. Like,
something
no.
like that. Yeah, and Saltzman himself, he kind of does that. I mean, he's more gentle in his approach and not so, you know, emboldened. And his other friend, John, is an older gentleman, senior citizen. You know, he looks like Mr. Natural. First place, you know, white beard, white hair. And he mumbles and says arcane shit about shit in a, you know, quiet voice with his eyes cast down. So he has to be enlightened because he's so, you know, shy and unintelligible. So this morning I went on Mr. Saltzman's Facebook page and I just wrote a little apology to, you know, Sudamo underneath the link for the meeting, that the recording of the meeting. Anyway, Beth tells me that I was edited out of the meeting, out of the recording. And that's appropriate. And then after I...
Not really, that's fucked up. I don't, I mean...
Well, and then after I, you know, I wrote something which I thought was, you know, kind of pithy in a semi-enlightened way. And then Saltzman just deleted that. So, all right, it's, you know, 7.6 billion people haven't come to the meeting, and I got deleted. My contribution to the Saltzman enterprise got deleted.
About her.
Did
they sell those recordings?
No, he does. He gives everything away. He's cool.
Why would they edit you out? I mean, that's an authentic experience had by someone who came to the talk.
You think?
That's fucked up.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, if you don't edit it out, I mean, because you don't like it, that's people are nuts.
Well, you know, I said to him later in the call, I said, you know, sometimes you have to bite the guru's leg just to see where he's going to go with it.
Well, they're all complacent babies.
Consider your leg bitten.
Be a certain way. And
yeah. That's right. It's all a show, one way or another. But he did, he was kind enough to jump on the Night Sky Sangha Facebook page and...
Who, Saltzman? Or
Saltzman. And liked, you know...
After he deleted all your stuff?
Liked the post. Yeah.
Like passive aggressive.
Well, I mean, it was very kind of him, you know, to cross-pollinate and put his stamp of liking approval on my, you know, modest and virtually unknown Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way this shit goes. Pretty dog-eat-dog out there in the Enlightenment world.
Well, it's like that. I mean, it's just everything is dripping with persona. And I just keep thinking, you know, I keep getting kind of sideswiped by these different personas, you know? Like, I'm like, no, this one's dressed all in white and, like, you know, has dreadlocks and probably be a certain... But no, it's just... And some of those are the worst, you know? You're like, maybe they'll be a little better, but no. if it's dripping with persona, it doesn't matter what kind of persona it is.
No.
It's like, ah, oh, you're just, you know, you're just like, step away, back away.
That's right.
Slowly.
Step away from the persona. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, it's nice not to have any credentials or lineage or pretend that you're aligned with a thing.
I mean, it all just becomes performance. And then, I mean, it's bizarre. Like, I just went and watched a show, you know, and, like, all... There was a performers, but they were getting on and off the stage, so there was a couple of different bands, so you got to see the performer and the audience, you know, which you don't always get to see.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got off the stage... It was fun. I mean, you know, they had like a certain little off the stage stick they did, but they didn't quite the performance. It's like you could see it just so clearly the separation of the persona, the you know, the performance, and then not quite sure what to do in the audience part. But the performance didn't follow them. That personality was like completely different on in the audience side, and in a lot of cases, whatever like. Kind of confidence and whatever they had on the stage, like all of that just kind of
seemed
very different, you know.
That's
like they were able to put that on the stage, but that it was just, I don't know.
Sure.
There was no authentic kind of confidence with, you know, about what this was. It's just that performer... You know, do a show, whip up a certain energy, and then that's it.
Yeah, you don't want to be Tom Petty all the time. Unless you're Tom Petty. And I'm sure he even had a problem with it. It's hard to be yourself. Or someone all the time. Yeah, so I tangled a little bit with the lovely Indian gentleman on the call. Muniandi was his name. And he was a little upset when, after he let everyone know that he's no longer seeking, and that he made a few comments, and there was some, I think Saltzman may have, you know, kind of clarified, or not quite refuted, but clarified some of his comments, or corrected him in a sense from his interpretation. And he probably didn't feel that good about that. Because, you know, if you portray yourself as a certain thing and then you say a certain thing, you want that thing to land with a certain authority. And if it doesn't land with a certain authority, well, now you have to kind of defend yourself. Yeah, I stopped seeking, and now I just enjoy whatever there is. All right. Good to know. You know, you want to be in possession of joy or insight or equanimity or wisdom, non-reactivity, you know, freedom from the body, freedom from the mind.
I don't even know. I don't even know that most people... That is their interest. It's more wanting to be seen, wanting to be kind of a celebrity, some verification, some of people acknowledge that me in some way, and that makes me kind of special. And
I don't know
if those, you know, the actual freedom may have any interest in it. Not really.
Kind of like if you're experiencing whatever you're experiencing in too tangible a way, you know, that's a sign. Well, if you believe your mind or your mood or your sensation or the story. Yeah, you know, if you're insisting on the tangible nature of present experience, yeah, you're a sucker, you know, you're a sucker for suffering. And why not? Now, if the habit of narrative association and orientation quiets down enough or relaxes enough, my sense is that, you know, you start to pick up the vibe of the intangibility of present experience. And the streaming nature of orientation and thinking and association and that relaxes, you know, sufficiently. You don't really have an orientation.
And it's just kind of like a natural, like, of course you don't have things to defend, though you might look defensive sometimes. So that's kind of bizarre, but like you're not defensive about your defensiveness. You know what I mean? But if you don't have any real solid orientation.
Like wanting peace, that could be a real bummer.
You know, things are going pretty well, I think, you know, any day now.
Yeah, the wanting, you know, of whatever it is, wanting whatever you're wanting. You know, the wanting, the craving is, it's already too much. Craving is already too much. And craving is, it's not that there's an I that craves. Craving is the I. Craving is the, right, anthropomorphization of self, and the you know, the on button of time. you know, a mind that conjures a sense of self in time or place, in context, that's unhappy. Instantly unhappy.
It's instantly irritated.
Oh, absolutely.
And confused, because it should be, it should be confused, you know, there's nothing to get a grip on. And so you're really grabbing at just little nothing, trying to pull it in to make it something.
Yeah.
And that requires a lot of work. You're trying to make something like rather large out of, tiny.
If I got even 5 cents an hour doing that, I'd be retired. Without benefits. Still be a wealthy man. So whatever this is, this malaise, uninvited malaise of self and time and orientation and implication and everything that's imagined, you know, that sets the tone. Then we want interventions to be relieved of that malaise. Or we want one or a thousand forms of security or imaginary friends like God.
Things to blame, like black people and slavery and whatever. Yes. We whip up in order to... It's like obvious. If you're irritated and, you know, someone bothers you, but you're, and you're already irritated, or something happens that triggers, you know, you're very triggered.
Yes.
Triggerable. And so all those things are just kind of...
If this is tangible,
of the irritation,
you are triggerable.
Yeah, very true. I mean,
you know, so even a guru will mutter under their breath, "Jesus Christ."
Waiting for a feather to come by.
Really, just a little feather, and I guess sets the whole thing in motion. Yeah, jeez, he does it. I mean, I wish someone had, you know, in Narasagadatta's living room just said, "Hey, dial it back."
He yelled, and people did, and he just
threw him out.
It up, and yeah, he didn't care. He was like, "Fuck you.
Yeah.
You don't want to be here. Get out."
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't give a shit.
Right.
People did say, I remember watching one where someone said, is he yelling at me? It's the interpreter.
Yeah.
And he was like, why is he yelling at me?
He loves you.
Yeah.
Because he loves you.
Yeah, but
he doesn't yell at just anybody.
He didn't tone it down.
Right.
You know? He just kept yelling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I took the risk to be thrown off the call to let Sudama reconsider his tone.
Can I rename myself?
Absolutely.
Sudamo?
Yes. Yes.
Tsunami, but cooler.
Sudamo Tsunami Biku. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. I'm distracted. Where
is that? I'm sure it's very... Yeah, Sudamo. It's gone now. You know, one is understandably full to the brim and overflowing with the history of orientation, the history of the imagination of oneself. Man, that's got to suck.
Well, now it's all documented and online, you know, because it's all on Facebook for most people. You have it, it's like more solid, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Before, you could kind of easily be like, "No, that didn't matter." They're like, "No, let me direct you to 2010 with this picture."
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, the amplification of, you know, the internet record, the Akashic record of the internet. So whatever you've tweeted or commented on or emailed or anything, you know.
And it's crazy because you can be, like, I have no relation to that person, that self or that person, but if I Google search my name sometimes, I'm like, oh, you know, not even me. I don't even know that person, but it's still there. There's still weird shit that just hangs out there.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, there's the archive in the so-called published record of the internet, and then there's the archive in one's own mind.
Right, but that seems to make it more, or it's just amped up right now. It seems very amped up. It's constant pictures put on Facebook, you know, show myself and make sure I'm relevant in real time. Everyone knows
sure.
what I'm doing, you know.
Yeah. It's, yeah, yes. So one can perhaps get a glimmer or more than a glimmer of the, you know, the matrix, the genesis of orientation, the Akashic record of oneself, the imagination of past experience, including the wounds and disappointments and the wins and the shame and the, you know, whatever we got. The good and bad days.
Yeah, because it's all mostly, like, dependent seemingly on how you feel in the moment. And so it's, that's fun, you know what I mean? It's not, it's just...
Yeah, the history, one's personal history and orientation, prior experience, percolates out of nowhere and appears to be, you know, defining. Or strangely, more strangely perhaps, is that we want and need it to be defining. If I'm a product of past impressions and I'm driven through uninvited malaise to generate more impressions, present impressions, as the way I live, then I'm fucked. It, you know, it's the fundamental codependency with consciousness. Thirsty, insatiably thirsty for impressions.
For patterns. It's like...
Patterns, yes.
Oh, I was just having this moment the other day that, like, just this being, all this wants to do is create patterns and grab onto them.
Yeah.
Where there are none. And it's great. It's fun, you know? I mean, I enjoy it. I like a good... song and a good story and a good whatever.
Of course, know. Yes.
But
yeah.
It's just like, that's just all it's doing. It's just creating patterns and kind of grabbing onto them. But it feels like it's playful, you know? It doesn't have to be so, like, avoidant in some... That's how I feel like I generally am, kind of a bit avoidant.
Yeah.
But it's really very... It's just like a random kid with a bunch of things that you put in front of it, and it's like, oh, well, let's see, put this shit, like, this pattern, and, like, throw it there, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
a Pollock painting.
Yeah, it's just like...
Just...
Splatter
and splatter impressions all over the place. Yeah, call it art. Here's my miserable self. It's art. That could be, is my bias, you know, that it is useful to see the engine, the geometry of impressions. Like, get underneath the, you know, implication of an involuntary impression field and just see the, you know, the impersonal nature of how the impression field arises and undulates and seduces one's attention, and how we play with the impression field and the play with that impression field, which might be innocent enough, you know, is the building blocks, the genesis of self. Because then the, you know, the like and the dislike, the attraction, the aversion, the accumulation or the refusal of what appears in the impression field is self. Is, you know, the pressure, performance pressure of whatever experiencing might be.
But you don't think that's only mostly though if you're filtering it through a persona in a sense? Because, I mean, there can be just kind of random patterns. Like, if you stare at something long enough, it really is like those pictures that don't look like anything.
Absolutely,
and,
I mean, yeah.
Anything, a carpet.
Right.
You know, if you stare single focused at something for long enough, it'll become something.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be filtered necessarily through the personality.
No, it doesn't have to be. No.
It could just be a strange experience between, time between, it's just, I don't know what it is.
Well, that's, yeah, see, right, raw data, whatever that implies, is so, can we say, intimately and fractally malleable.
It's so valuable. It's crazy.
That shit's crazy.
Crazy valuable.
Yeah, and so if
like,
one's...
I've never seen putty like this before.
No, right.
This is not That's your right. typical putty.
I'm Gumby!
I'm Gumby.
It turns out that I'm Gumby. I had no idea.
Gumby has too much form.
Yeah, Gumby's got way too much. You're more like, you know, Q. On Star Trek. He was like a total superhero. He could come and go as he pleased. He could manifest and demanifest, play with the universe at his whim. He, you know, it was like the entire manifestation was his, you know, playpen. That's how cool he was. Yeah. So that's a you know, a useful aspect of the yoga. The yoga of observation, the yoga of, you know, discovery. Narration and the association of self with narration is too gross. It's not in tight enough. It's not close enough. So it hides from the shocking, malleable nature of fractal impression, to create the hallucination of a durable or durational self. That's the building block of narrative. Oh, whatever attention it is could possibly have the capacity, the curious capacity to hard to, you know, put into words or describe too clearly, but become so intimate with the malleability of the impression field before narration gets in the way, and now, you know, you're on an LSD bender. Without the LSD, yeah. You're on an LSD bender without the LSD. Yeah. Once the illusion of...
The most boring...
yeah.
Not as easy, maybe, but...
Right.
That's fully white room that was well lit was instantly
true. Wow.
Anyway.
Well, with the relaxation of tangibility. Attention rather than being accusatory through narrative and association and implication and psychological time. Attention gets, you know, quieter and quieter, quieter and quieter. So then one is no longer, you know, object dependent. If you're not object dependent, you don't have a lot to say.
We're not in search of objects, and it's definitely not in a kind of gropey way. I don't know how else to say that, but like a needy. And so they're free to appear and come and go, however.
Yeah.
But it's a lot like looser and playful.
Well, yeah, I mean, Paul Hederman uses that traveling lighter phrase, right, for good reason. The action figure, you know, is not taking the apparitional, its own apparitional appearance all that seriously. But even then, you know, a good seeker tends to latch on to whatever might be spoken and then tries to, you know, emulate it, let's say, right?
You're going to be like, why is it better just skipping through experience?
Yeah.
Maybe wearing white.
Right. We try to emulate whatever is spoken through, you know, behavioral feelers or experiential feelers. And usually one wants to be relieved of apprehension and fear and guilt and emotion and, you know, all that stuff. But still remain, you know, somehow cogent, tangible. I want to feel better about things. But I think this is taking another elevator, you know, another floor down or up. Down or up, doesn't matter.
Yeah, you keep, like, dialing it back. Like,
yeah.
I was just reading some more, for some odd reason, James Baldwin, you know, that guy? A black guy who, whatever, I don't know, like, what do I call him? Who, mm-hmm. you know, is involved in, like, when Martin Luther King and all that was, you know, but he had a very uh-huh. different spin on things, but he constantly is, he was a very good writer, but he constantly was coming back to the primary, why does the white man need the black man? And it's kind of like that primary,
yeah, yeah.
He caught on to the fact that the reason that there was slavery in some sense is our agitation. We're irritated. If there's some fundamental kind of, like, irritation, agitation,
yeah.
whatever.
He looks a little like Johnny Mathis, right? James Baldwin.
I can't put it together. Yeah, he's definitely had a flair about him that
oh,
was
yeah.
maybe he was gay at the time.
Yeah,
or, I
yeah,
don't
yeah.
know, but
he had a certain flair, artsy, elocution.
Very well spoken.
Oh, yeah, brilliant. Fucker.
Feminine, kind of a little bit, yeah, but
yes.
you know, artistic kind of.
Yeah.
Thing. But he just didn't take it, you know what I mean? It's like he kind of, he just doesn't take it far enough. Like, what's causing that? He didn't
no,
quite know.
Right.
He was kind of asking the question. But
yeah.
like that
right.
self-absorbed, narcissistic psychosis.
Yeah.
You know, you have to get
yeah.
under that kind of.
Right.
It just wants to keep reinventing itself.
Yes. I mean, he was exploring, you know, the tragedy of racism and enslavement. Through a certain lens, which was a very, you know, I mean, it was a provocative and remarkable and enlightening lens.
Yeah, Yeah, he was very involved for a while as a minister and had lots of bizarre experiences and whatever. But I think he was just investigating his experience and you know, coming up with these things. But it just didn't take it quite. The holodeck was a little bit.
He didn't go. He didn't go as far as Muji.
No.
Yeah, I mean, exploitation and extinction, the white man, you know, shooting buffalo for sport, decimating flocks.
Pattern of bullshit over and over, you know. Something, someone, something to be prejudiced or hate against, whether it's Muslims, pit bulls, or...
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Right.
It just keeps recycling. It's old. It's recycled.
Yes.
Crap.
Yes.
Yeah, get resources, hoard things.
Existentially, this is really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you don't know what to do. I think you're like a little person in a big world, limited resources. Every man for themselves. I mean, you know,
well, sure. A total
groups of friends. And
mayhem ensues, you know. Mayhem ensues. Yeah. Well, the one of these articles I was reading on you know, the plight of humanity.
One of the many.
I was surprised that later on in the article, the author, you know, a PhD student in his late 20s, who was very articulate and, you know, and overly documented his work, you know, it was really over PhD'd it, but that's okay. I mean, he did piece together some really cogent and useful stuff.
He really has to. I've tried to write stuff in that environment before without doing it, and they're like, where did you just make this up?
Yeah, exactly. You're not allowed to have any insight on your own.
At all.
Yeah, you'll have to just borrow from the...
Yeah.
Right.
No free association allowed.
Yeah, all you're allowed to do is write a filler sentence to link another footnote.
Yeah, and then you can write like a kind of conclusion, and that's it.
Yeah. So, that nails it. So he was offering, you know, self-realization as a really good way to spend one's time in light of the potential of near-term human extinction.
Yeah, where are you fucking going? I mean,
and I was like, cool.
You know, hangs out in the hope realm.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
It was.
Did he say what
cool.
his idea of enlightenment, or what he meant by that at all?
Not really, no. I mean, you know, he quoted Ken Wilber a little too much. That pissed me off.
But then again, everything pisses me off.
Yeah, then again, if you're doing a PhD piece, you know, and Ken Wilber is a, you know, an egomaniac but well-accepted erudite scholar in the field.
He's accredited.
Then, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. You can credit him because he's so widely published and widely read. You know, that gives him street cred.
Credit.
It does.
Imaginary credit. You've got credit.
Yeah. You've got mail. Yeah, but he mentioned a few other, you know, Jay Krishnamurti. I think he may have mentioned even Ramana Maharshi or something, and I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, 29-year-old scholarly young man writing on a very challenging, provocative topic, you know, pointing out the dead end, that is, overshoot, over-reliance on fossil fuels and, you know, exponential population growth has to lead to collapse. No other choice. And that as you cope with, you know, that realization and the potential of, you know, near-term collapse because of the stresses that we're seeing climate-wise, that it would be a good idea to, you know,
get
enlightened or something. Yeah, get serious, yeah. I was like, hey. I said, hey, you're singing my song, man. Come join us at the Night Sky Song.
You can email them or something?
Mm-mm. Don't know. Wasn't my cup of tea, I guess.
I'm gonna go, what's your cup of tea? Come on.
Well, I like reading about it. I don't necessarily want to be friends with the guy. Yeah. I don't have any credentials. You would just...
Yeah, it's difficult in that environment. I mean, in all environments where they want accredited. I was just on the Lightworkers Accredited Association.
Oh, I want to join
that. It's like a group of people, but you have to be accredited.
By whom?
To go on there, the Lightworkers Association.
How do you get it?
Accredited, I don't know. There's
what do you have to do?
You have to, you know, go through their process. And,
oh, all right.
I don't know, right? It's all make-believe, weird,
it's all
tribal,
make-believe.
Bullshit groups of people who yeah. think that, you know, oh, just has to be vetted to whatever imaginary, you know, thing.
Yeah.
And the educational system is like the worst with that. I mean, you know, it has to be in line with our philosophy to some extent, even though we pretend to be really open, you know.
Jeez, I've heard that before.
We're not at all.
Well, the, you know, the impulse for tangibility of self, of predicament, circumstance, you know, is synonymous with creating authority.
Yeah, I like that the dude you sent out, I don't remember his name, but I wrote, I haven't gotten through all of it, but some of it, and he was pointing out, you know, the general malaise of how bad and how deep the propaganda is.
Yes.
And also, you know, trying to get under this kind of, like, he was also doing the same, like, showing how you just keep ending back up in the little system, even though you think you're out, and you just keep going right back in, because you don't get how far, you know.
Oh, boy.
Like, how deep in it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he also said he got attacked from people, university or, you know,
sure.
No longer.
Oh, yeah.
Some things he said.
You don't want to pull the chain on this thing. You're going to get noticed. If you're in, you know, academia or something like that, you start pulling the chain. I don't know how Alan Watts got away with it.
And he was, I know, that's, he did. But... Yeah, he was friendly, and I mean, he wasn't. No, he did. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, somehow he did. He was certain way about it. It's funny. Not a lot of people did. I can't think of anyone else that really got away with it.
Yeah, well, they put Tim Leary in jail. He lived in a houseboat and he drank. That's how he got away with it.
Did he work for a university till he...
I don't know his biography, you know,
yeah,
academic
know
biography well enough.
I know at some point he was.
Yeah. He probably got more wild after he'd retired. He went emeritus or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, he still played somewhat of a philosophical...
Yeah.
He was not accusing people of government indirectly claimed killing civilians. That's, you know, different.
This is out of control. It used to be in control. Now it's out of control. Well, the, you know, the amplification power of, you know, internet, the, you know, instant communication for written and video and whatever, changes the telepathic capacity of the species in, I mean, absolutely profound ways that we're first, you know, at the cusp of beginning to understand. And the people that work on it 24/7, like Amazon and Google and Apple and, you know, whomever, Facebook, you know, they're working these algorithms 24/7 with, you know, thousands and tens of hundreds of thousands of people on staff.
And they so, don't know what the fuck they're doing under the radar.
Right.
They don't know.
So they're leveraging, you know, obviously the great financial success, their remarkable power over the medium that is, you know, social media or internet, telepathy. I mean, before the internet, you know, proliferated, what was the means of, you know, communication and consensus? Like the alt-right, let's say. Take the alt-right or some other, you know, things that are kind of unpleasant. You know, how would they communicate with each other before the internet? Well, newsletters that had to be mailed.
Yeah.
I mean, before the internet, shit had to be mailed. Pamphlets, you know, you needed Panera to talk about white supremacy. You know, so it's really hard to get a lot of momentum when you're kind of a disparate fringe of, you know, angry haters that want to decimate everyone that's not you. But then you empower this dispersed fringe with instant communication, right? Now it mushrooms into being. The consensus reality becomes, you know, profound instantaneously. And of course, so should it be for, you know, call it progressive intentions.
Then it seems like initially that was the case, but now it just seems so scattered. There's just too much. Everything just spins off into little fragments.
Yes.
So now it's just like it needs to be defragged.
Yes.
It needs a big time defragged.
The same, let's, you know, as above, so below, right? The same fracticality that you can potentially perceive as one's mind becomes sensitively attuned to present experience, that same chaos, you know, miraculous chaos, is also found in the, right, the distracting body of the internet, of 7.6 billion or whoever's contributing to media to have their own story. It's like everyone is this, you know, Facebook kind of made everyone a celebrity, available to be, you know, voyeuristically enjoyed across the world.
Yeah, and YouTube, I mean,
yes.
You don't need any, get on there and
yeah.
Start talking.
Yeah. And, you know, talented people that know how to leverage, let's say, the medium of, you know, YouTubes and everything else, many of them have become, you know, celebrities, wealthy, whatever.
People have become celebrities just by having, like, a lot of Facebook.
Yeah. The bombardment of etheric impression field through, you know, electronic wireless media is unprecedented in the, you know, so-called history of species.
As far as we
know.
Civilizations that are just buried.
Oh, yeah. Like, if you want to go back to Atlantis, they probably had an awesome internet.
I have no idea.
I don't know. Or the Egyptians, or the ancient aliens. I don't know. And the, you know, the connection that is face-to-face, or, you know, with the natural world, is usurped by the electronic communication. Yeah, no wonder, you know, we're going more and more insane. More and more fractured and disenfranchised and subject to, you know, violation.
We're so distracted. No one is paying any attention. It's like, ugh.
Yeah.
It's so distracted.
Yeah. And the political, you know, the corporations and the politicians and the whatever, clearly taking advantage of all that distraction to pursue agendas that are not life-affirming. And there's not enough outrage.
Certainly not enough serious protests, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Everybody likes their whatever spoiled white lifestyle, even if it's not that spoiled. It's just comfortable enough. I don't know. You know, it's just,
yeah. The hunger for more impressions, or impressions to heal former impressions. Creates a loop of fractured existential disquietude. Weaning oneself from voracious pursuit of impressions, you know, perhaps is counterintuitive.
Well, even, I mean, the language is just saying that, right? Like, the first kind of image, sigil that comes in my head is of a person just leaning themselves down, just, you know, from down to zero or something, you know, so then you'll just have a person that still, right, like, it's just the way the language is kind of taught and, you know, interpreted and spoken.
It's difficult. That's some scary shit. It's very challenging to, you know, have no merit, no utility, to not seek or give recognition. Sure, yeah. If you can find one, I can respond to it.
Someone has questions. Who's on there?
Someone's threatening to ask a question.
Say who they are.
Oh, no, I know who it is. The death of a spiritual mentor. Oh. Yeah, weep. Yeah, weeping is good. You know, love and grief. Love and gratitude and grief, appreciation, you know, sacred buoyancy. You lose a, you know, lose a friend like that. Crying is good. You know, our, whatever our identity might be, however much or little we think we have of one, you know, is inexorably, mysteriously tied or linked to the entire impression field of, you know, humanity or consciousness. So, I mean, if we felt, intimate with someone and heard, esteemed, cared for by a friend, a mentor, and, you know, that relationship ends by virtue of, you know, their passing, you know, takes a big chunk out of your soul. We're, you know, we're buoyed by, maybe made out of to some extent, the richness of our impression field as a person, as a body, as a human, emotionally and sentimentally, and good times and not good times, and certainly, you know, spiritual kinds of stuff can have a certain flair, you know, or zing, depth to it, that's really endearing. You know, and whatever guru yoga is, you know, affection is the enzyme, an enzyme that helps to dissolve ignorance. You know, prideful association and prideful identification. So that, you know, that kind of affection is a really potent solvent. On the rocky road to whatever realization might be. And certainly, you know, loss of camaraderie. You know, it's deliciously painful. The grief is transmutative. Empathy affection love valuing a person in the matrix of one's life you know that's an awesome gift of living. When it comes to a close, by virtue of someone's passing, one hopes that the grief is of the same measure as the love. The grief should be devastating. The grief should be annihilating, unmanageable. And that's a great sign that the relationship was a treasure. You know, one hopes, if that's appropriate, that the rocky road to realization, you know, the serendipitous journey of a crazy life, does not result in some kind of indifference. Passion for all things is not mutually exclusive. It's a great gift to feel. You know, great, privilege or obligation. Transcendent gift to feel. Now, smart yoga, put a value spin on it. Smart yoga, you know, would be to take all of the feeling, all of it, and, you know, use it as fuel for passion, fuel for seeing, fuel for discovery. Refusing nothing. If life's a train wreck, you may as well pull on the whistle. Choo choo. thanks for joining us, everyone. Appreciate your being here. See you next time.